This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 346 was produced on October 20th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. GavCal co-founder Louis Vincent Gav returns as this week's feature interview guest, and I think you're really going to love this interview. Louis says it's all about the pivot, but he's not talking about the so-called Powell pivot almost everyone else is fixated on. Louis says what's far more important is when China's Xi Jinping pivots from zero COVID policy to reopening the Chinese economy, which Louis says will send a macroeconomic shockwave through global markets that will reignite inflation and have more overall effect than the Fed pivot most market participants are obsessed with.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Louis Vincent Gav, when Eric, Nick, and I discuss if there's more downside to the S&P 500 and will the U.S. dollar make new highs, and we'll also give technical updates on crude oil, natural gas, gold, copper, and uranium. Now, Eric, before we move on to our feature interview guest, let's cover crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory data.
Patrick, EIA inventory came in with crude oil drawing down 1.7 million barrels. Now, it was really a 5.3 million barrel drawdown, but the SPR draw of 3.6 million barrels offset that, leaving 1.7 in the headline figure. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is at its lowest level in 38 years, but I would argue it's actually at its lowest level ever from the perspective that 38 years ago, they were still in the process of the initial filling of the SPR, which took several years after it was commissioned. So I think we're basically at all-time reckless here. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 583,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 114,000 barrels. Distillates building a de minimis 124,000 barrels. Diesel inventories are a really big deal. All of the attention going into the midterm elections, of course, is on gasoline, which is what the consumer feels the most. But diesel inventories are at extreme low levels. A lot of very smart people. Tracy Shuchard has been blogging about this for, I don't know, 6 months, feels like a year almost. Pat Hemsworth has been talking about this quite a bit. It's really important to understand that while the voters may care most about the gasoline, diesel is what really runs the commercial trucks and therefore the economy. If we are to have a shortage of diesel, that means that it's going to dramatically increase shipping costs, which are an input cost to just about everything, reigniting inflation, and then it's all a reinforcing vicious cycle from there. U.S. production ticked back up to 12 million barrels this week. There were some very suspicious, and I would go so far as to say manipulative, trading patterns in the front month futures contract. That's the December delivery contract on WTI crude oil on Tuesday morning, the first of which about 15 minutes before the official open of the market at 9 o'clock. Of course, Globex trades almost 24 hours a day, so around 8:45 was the first of four separate volume spikes where somebody on each one of those dumped about 2,000 contracts or more than 2,000 contracts in the course of a few seconds. Now, a lot of the people on Twitter just didn't understand this when I posted the chart. So the fact that the Mexican oil hedge is closing and the fact that there were rumors floating around about President Biden's announcement of the SPR, it doesn't have anything to do with this. Nobody dumps 2,000 contracts. That's 2 million barrels of oil, $170 million worth of oil in a single mouse click. Nobody does that ever unless they're intentionally trying to spike the market lower. So I don't know what's going on here or who's behind it, but there's some awfully sloppy selling that was going on. That was before President Biden talked about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and his intentions there. They have made an official announcement to release another 15 million million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now they've also said that they will supposedly refill the SPR when crude oil gets down to $67 to $72. That's their new range. Well, hey, wait a minute. Didn't they say the exact same thing just a couple of weeks ago, and then it was $80 at that point? Now it's $67 to $72. Once the price gets closer to that, what are they going to change it to next? One astute person on Twitter said, hey, wait a minute. If you look at the long-dated contracts in 2024, they're trading below $72 right now. So why doesn't the president put his money where his mouth is? Go ahead and buy those long-dated contracts now and lock in that delivery to refill the SPR. Needless to say, they're not doing that. So this is more politics than reality in terms of these announcements. I won't be the slightest bit surprised if there is another announcement of even more oil to come out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The White House has already alluded to the possibility, as market conditions warrant, if necessary. And of course, they scapegoat OPEC Plus for being the bad guys here, when in reality, it is U.S. policy that is to blame here. Louis Gav will have more to say about this in the feature interview, specifically about scapegoating OPEC Plus and picking fights around the world, which is something that Louis and I agree the U.S. really ought to think twice before doing. As I've said for months, the big catalyst to propel oil prices much higher is going to be China coming out of COVID lockdown and reopening their economy. Louis Gav is going to have plenty about that to say in the feature interview.
Now, this week's feature interview guest is GavCal co-founder Louis Vincent Gav. Eric, why did we get Louis back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Louis is a very international man. We're a French guy, moved to Hong Kong to start GavCal, an institutional research firm, which he and his dad founded. He's also, I'm not sure if he's a Canadian citizen or just a permanent resident, but he has a home in Canada. Very multicultural, multilingual, and international, very well-traveled guy. I wanted to get that international perspective from someone who doesn't really have a personal bias toward the views of either his home country or his current country of residence, to really look at this overall situation that's going on in the world between the geopolitical conflicts and markets and everything else from a nationally independent perspective. And Louis is also one of the smartest guys that we know. So I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Louis Vincent Gav is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is GavCal co-founder Louis Vincent Gav. Louis, I am so excited to get you back on the show. As I'm sure you know, as you're a regular listener, lately I've been having trouble finding people to disagree with me and bring a little bit of bullishness to the table. I admit to being the guy who's usually the biggest skeptic in the room, but lately everybody's telling me it's worse than I think. And I remember at our Macro Voices live event, you were not at all hesitant to call me out when you disagreed. I don't even remember what I said, but I remember the answer was, "And people think Luke Grohman is crazy." I don't remember what I said, but I know you're not afraid to set me straight. So listen, I am a little bit concerned because it looks to me like we've got a heck of a liquidity crisis on our hand. I see the U.S. dollar index running away, and people say, "Well, yeah, but that's just because the euro and the yen are crashing. That's all." It's like, well yeah, no kidding. That's the problem. And I think the reason that the stock market is not outright crashing, Louis, is because everybody knows the Fed pivot is just around the corner. I don't see why they think that, given the data. So I'm still in gloomy mode. Set me straight.
Well, first, thanks a bunch for having me, Eric. It's always great to catch up. Look, there's a lot to be gloomy about right now, right? The world is changing very rapidly in front of our eyes. And yes, to your point on hope springs eternal, I think today the one sort of clutch of hope that people can hold on to is the belief that it's okay. The Fed will ride in on its with its magic cape and turn it around for us just in time for year end, and maybe I can get a bonus at the end of the year. I have my own vision of this sort of hope springs eternal, except that it's not Jay Powell that arrives with the cavalry, but it's Xi Jinping. And let me explain my own sort of hope springs eternal thinking. I think there's something pretty odd going on in the world right now. And as you point out, we're in an obvious liquidity crisis, right? All the signs are there. Shrinking central bank reserves, which clearly tells you there's not enough money to go around. US dollars shooting up tells you there's not enough dollars in the system. And of course, asset prices falling. But the odd thing is, the US current account deficit could not be any bigger than it is right now. I mean, right now, the US is sending $300 billion every quarter to the rest of the world. That's $100 billion a month that the US consumer is pushing to the rest of the world. And it's almost like the rest of the world is taking this money and saying, that's not enough, even though that's more than the rest of the world has ever made. So how can we be in a world where, on the one hand, the US current account deficit is bigger than it's ever been, and on the other, there's not enough dollars to go around? I've been really struggling with it. It's almost as if the US is sending, the US consumer is sending money, and that money is just going down some kind of black hole and disappearing. And perhaps that's what is somewhat happening. And that black hole happens to be China. When you look at the US current account deficit, it's so the $100 billion a month, 50 to 60 of that goes to China. Now, I think historically, the Chinese toy manufacturer or the guy who makes tennis shoes or whatever else on the other side of that trade would have taken that money, and that money would have been recycled one way or the other decently quickly. Maybe the toy manufacturer takes his girlfriend to Paris and buys her 10 LVMH handbags. Or maybe the tennis shoe manufacturer buys himself an apartment in Vancouver. Or maybe just a house in an apartment in Shanghai. And as he does, he changes his US dollars for renminbi. The central bank ends up with the renminbi and puts them back in US treasuries. That money gets recycled. But, and this is perhaps the one of the bigger anomalies in our system that people aren't thinking through enough, what you have today is the world's second largest economy and by far largest exporter on lockdown still. And I know it's not lockdown. I know it's dynamic lockdown. But for all intents and purposes, each time you go to the supermarket in China, you worry that, hey, they may shut down the supermarket because somebody just tested positive for COVID and I'm going to be stuck there for 3 weeks. So that doesn't really generate much economic activity, right? I mean, most people in China right now are going to work, going home, going to the corner store getting food, and that's it. And so all this money, this $50 billion, $60 billion a month that China is making is perhaps just sort of stuck there in the system. And I highlight this because today everybody's waiting for the Fed pivot. Personally, I'm waiting for the Xi Jinping pivot because I think there's basically this Chinese zero COVID. Imagine a huge dam that's sort of holding up this mass of liquidity. And this huge dam is China's COVID policies. And when that goes, it's going to, unleash a wave of course, domestic growth to begin with. We've seen everywhere that stopped lockdown, have big parties, right? The first thing people do when the lockdowns leave is they go to the restaurant, they go visit their parents, they go visit friends, tourism booms. So that's the first thing we can expect. But the second thing we can expect is probably all of a sudden capital outflows out of China and into assets around the world to be reignited in a way that it's just never been before. Now, I was saying, people waiting for the Fed pivot, it's hope spring eternal. personally, I've been waiting, and I've been wrong, I've been waiting for the Xi Jinping pivot on zero COVID for over a year. You know, I thought it would come with the Olympic Games. I think we talked about it at the time. I thought, post the Olympic Games will be a good time for China to reopen. Instead of reopening, we had the super harsh lockdowns of Shanghai. So, you know, that crushed that hope. Today, obviously, is the hope that post the Party Congress and perhaps pre-Chinese New Year, you know, does China want to go through a third Chinese New Year where travel is discouraged and people can't visit their families, that you see a loosening of a lot of the restrictions? I guess we'll know in the coming days. If we do, so, you know, you're asking me for a bullish argument. Imagine that China moves away from zero COVID. I'm not saying they will. I'm saying imagine. Then all of a sudden, the demand for all sorts of basic materials, the demand for luxury goods. I'll give you just an example. I just went around Europe visiting clients, and the hotel rooms that used to cost me 200 euros now cost 400 euros, and you can't get room service at night because they don't have enough staff anymore. What happens when the Chinese tourists come back? That probably goes from 400 euros to 600 euros. So we live in a world that's already been inflationary without Chinese demand. If Chinese demand is now unleashed, where do we end up? I guess that's the big question for me for the coming year.
Louis, I want to touch on how we got stuck in zero COVID policy in China in the first place, because the experts that I think have been most right throughout the crisis, people like Dr. John Campbell in the UK, have said once you get to the R-naught levels of Omicron, it just doesn't make sense to consider lockdowns as an intervention anymore. They work at lower transmission rates, but at the Omicron transmission rate, it just has to be allowed to burn through. And it simply does not serve any purpose to have these continuing lockdowns. Now, that's led, there's conspiracy theories that say, oh, China knows that they could unlock, but they're doing it in order to keep their people enslaved or something. You know, that doesn't make sense to me. They want their economy to come back. And I don't think by any means that they're stupid. If there's anything I learned from living in Hong Kong, it is that China is an extremely sophisticated, intelligent society, maybe different culture and different values than we're used to, but they're no dummies. What's going on here? Why do they have these policies that, as far as I can tell, don't serve their own interests?
I think there's only two ways to look at this. One of the ways is the one you just highlighted. It's a tool of political control that is exerted by the party over its own population. That's option one. And it could be a tool, you know, some people have expressed a view it's a tool of political control. It's a tool of economic control. Make sure that you don't get capital flight at a time when you're correcting through real estate, etc. So that's option one. I don't really buy it. I think the only possible explanation is that Xi Jinping made a massive mistake when COVID outbreak started. He said, I'm in charge of this. This is a big deal. I'm in charge of this file. I'll handle this. Now, you know, you've worked in enough organizations to know that the first rule of management is that if something really bad happens, you delegate somebody to it. Like this, when the thing doesn't get fixed, you can say, okay, I had put Sam in charge of fixing this, but Sam has done a terrible job. So now I'm firing Sam and I'm putting Mike in charge instead. And Xi Jinping, having basically put himself in charge, put himself in a situation where A, of course, nobody wanted to contradict him, and B, there was really no turning back. And I think one of the big problems for China, and I'm sure you've met people like this in the past couple of years, is that by all accounts, it looks like Xi Jinping is one of these people that is deeply COVID paranoid. And I've met a lot of people like this, of course, you know, colleagues, friends. And to some extent, it's the more people read about COVID, the more they became paranoid about it, right? Which makes sense. You know, the more you read about a disease, the scarier it looks typically. So I think Xi Jinping decided, I'm going to be in charge of this. I'm going to read everything there is about it. And the more he read, the more he freaked himself out. And so you get stuck in the situation we're in. Now, the one silver lining to this pretty dark cloud is that when you look at the Chinese Communist Party, The Chinese Communist Party is first and foremost in the game of providing social stability. And you and I have discussed this in the past. Much more than delivering economic growth, the Chinese Communist Party is about delivering social stability because that comes at a huge premium in China after 150 years of anarchy, you know, civil war, famines, etc. Now, what you've seen lately in Shenzhen and Chengdu, out of the more recent lockdowns, is you're starting to see people push back. They've actually had to unleash riot police in Chengdu and Shenzhen because people were starting to push back against the idea of lockdowns. So, you know, for 2.5 years, there was an economic cost to China of the lockdowns, but, you know, they could bear it. They didn't really mind. But there was no real social and political cost. This is now starting to change. People are now starting to push back. And so, you know, that is perhaps my one hope and why I still believe in the Xi Jinping pivot, is that they're going to need to pivot, not because economically they need to, although they do, but because politically it might be dangerous for them if they don't. And so that fundamentally will be the reason why they would change. And so, you know, the more they lock down, the more they run the risk of riots, the more riots you start to get, the less likely they are to keep the current policy. So I think the long-winded answer to your question, but obviously the zero COVID has been a policy mistake of epic proportions. And it's a policy mistake that needs to be put in at Xi Jinping's feet. Whether he did it out of some sort of nefarious view or because he panicked, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. It leaves you in the same place. What matters is where do you go from here? Do you continue on the zero COVID mistake or do you start changing? In other words, what are we first likely to see? Are we first likely to see a Fed pivot or are we first likely to see a Xi Jinping pivot? Arguably, we've seen massive policy mistakes all around the world. The Fed policies and the fiscal spending and the crazy monetary policies during the COVID years, that was ridiculous and we're today paying the price. And we've had also very wrong policies in China with the zero COVID. Now, today, we're stuck in a situation where for the markets to rebound, you either need the Fed to pivot or Xi Jinping to pivot. Which will happen first? Because importantly, it doesn't lead to the same outcome. It doesn't lead to the same things rebounding, right? If you say tomorrow, Fed is going to pivot, then you think, okay, I'm going to go out and buy the U.S. growth stocks. I'm going to go out and buy maybe U.S. treasuries again. However, if it's Xi Jinping who pivots first, I'm going to go out and buy commodities. I'm going to go out and buy emerging markets. I'm going to bet that the U.S. dollar rolls over hard. So it's not exactly the same plays depending on which pivot you have first.
Okay, I agree completely that the Xi Jinping pivot is probably bigger, if not as big as the Fed. And we clearly want to figure out what do we look for as early signals to tell us it's coming. Now, if I invoke what you said about organizational dynamics and think back to my own corporate days, okay, what I would expect Xi Jinping to do if he's the CEO of a major Fortune 500 company is first declare success that his personal leadership over the lockdown was a great success and everything went beautifully. And now, because the transition out of lockdown, it doesn't require his personal skill, he's going to delegate that to Joe, and that way Joe is expendable if Joe screws it up and it won't be his fault. So it seems to me the thing to watch for would be Xi Jinping appointing somebody or creating a czar of the unlockdown, if you will. Would we know that if it was happening? I don't know nearly as much as you do about Chinese politics and how this all works. They've got this Congress going on right now. They actually just delayed the release of their economic data during their National Congress. I would think that would be a logical time if Xi Jinping wants to declare that he succeeded on the lockdown and somebody else is in charge of unlocking down the economy. Would that be the time for it to happen?
You would think, right? That's my thinking exactly. You would think that this current party Congress is a great time to do this. All the more so since the U.S. just threw a massive artillery barrage at China with the announcement that basically the semiconductor restrictions that were on Huawei are now going to be implemented all across Chinese corporates and the broader Chinese economy. So if you're Xi Jinping, this gives you the great out, right? You can easily say, okay, you can make a speech, say, you know what, more than a million people died of COVID in the US, more than a million people died of COVID in Europe. But, you know, we in China, we had very few deaths. So well done us. And yes, I now pass this on to X, Y, or Z, who's going to handle this, because the new big problem for us is that the US is trying to prevent us from rising to our legitimate role in the global economy by restricting us access to semiconductors. So, you know, our new number one mantra now is going to have to be to become technologically independent. And for that to happen efficiently, you know, my clear and forthright leadership is going to be needed. So I'm, you know, I can't be on everything at once. So I'm going to be focusing on that from here on out. So, you know, that'd be the obvious speech to make, right? And what's interesting, if you look at his kickoff speech, and if you look at the number of times each the various phrases appear in the report, Xi Jinping, yesterday in his speech, he mentioned 91 times the word security. And as opposed, if you go back to 10 years ago, in his first maiden speech, he mentioned it 33 times. So that's three times as much. Meanwhile, in his maiden speech, Xi Jinping had mentioned 105 times the word economy, and yesterday he mentioned it only 60 times. If you look at science and technology, he mentioned science and technology 41 times yesterday. He mentioned it 12 times in 2012. So his whole speech yesterday, his maiden, you know, his inauguration of the Party Congress, was about security and was about science and technology. It wasn't about economy and it wasn't about reform. Those were the buzzwords 10 years ago. The buzzwords today, security, science, and technology. So, you know, perhaps we're setting ourselves up for that. Perhaps not. Here's the thing. We'll know in 10 days. I don't think it makes any sense to go out and say, oh, we're seeing the Xi Jinping pivot. You know, we don't know yet. But I think we'll know in the coming days or a week or two. And what you have to be ready is to think, okay, if there is a Xi Jinping pivot, because I don't think we're going to see a Fed pivot in the next 2 weeks. So if there's going to be a Xi Jinping pivot, what would I buy? How would I position my portfolio and be ready to act if and when it came? If it doesn't come, well, you've done preparatory work for nothing, but you haven't lost any money. And if it comes, you're ready to act, because then the market moves could be quite big and quite violent.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating, Louis, because as you know, my whole thesis around the global energy crisis is that we've already proven through market action that even without China coming out of COVID, we can't really get back to pre-pandemic normal, because there simply isn't enough energy supply. There's not enough oil supply in order to do that. And my whole thesis has been that when China comes out of their lockdowns, that's going to be the moment where we see a huge move up in oil prices. Now, just this week, Bloomberg's Javier Blas, probably the smartest analyst or reporter in the oil market, penned an article which I think was a message to President Biden, and I sure hope he's listening. And what it said basically was, look, we got to think really carefully about the threats that are being levied with this NOPEC bill. What President Biden is trying to do, I think, is to resurrect the NOPEC bill that's been floating around for years and years. And it would essentially authorize the United States to apply its own antitrust legislation or its antitrust laws to what Saudi Arabia does on its own sovereign territory, which doesn't make any sense. To me, it just spits in the face of the rule of law. But that's what they're doing, or that's what they want to do. What Javier Blas said is, look, think about what's going on, Mr. President. He didn't address it to Biden. I'm writing that into the story. But what he's saying is, think about what the next volley is going to be. The next move of the Saudis is going to be to dump their U.S. Treasury holdings and start pricing their oil in a currency other than the U.S. dollar as their next move to counter what Biden does with the NOPEC bill. Now, you could argue that, okay, this whole theory that, you know, Saudi Arabia could dump its treasuries and that would crash the bond market has been overhyped by conspiracy theorists for years. Well, okay, We've got an incredibly vulnerable moment in the bond market, Louis, already. This is not a good time for anybody to be intentionally dumping U.S. Treasury holdings as a tool of economic warfare, which is what Javier Blas seems to think could happen if this NOPEC bill is resurrected. So if you had that, which could really have an impact on the U.S. bond market, and China reopening at the same time. I mean, just imagine the next 10 days that they manage to pass the NOPEC bill and China announces it's coming out of COVID lockdown. Okay, I'm going back into gloom and doom mode. I can't help it. But Louis, this scares the crap out of me.
Well, look, I think Franklin Delano Roosevelt was smart enough to know that he couldn't really fight a war on two fronts at the same time. He decided, you know, first we clean up Europe, and then once we've cleaned up Europe, we'll turn to Japan. We'll do what we must to contain Japan. But the wrath of the U.S. Navy was really only turned against Japan in starting in 1945. Right, once it was pretty clear that Germany was done. I highlight this because fighting a war on many fronts is, you know, it's a big ask. And of course, back in the 1940s, the U.S. had, you know, it was full-scale war and war effort and all this. But right now, it seems to me that the U.S. obviously has a fight with Russia on, which is fine. But it's choosing this time to also have a fight with China and to, in essence, amp up its fight with China with the blocking of the semiconductors. And at the same time, is now picking a fight with OPEC. Now, I would say that's probably one fight, maybe even two fights too many. It seems to me pretty hubristic from the United States to pick three fights at the same time. Now, I get that the U.S. is super powerful. I get that they control the world's sea lanes. I get that they control the world's semiconductor industry. But what you know the old rule of is divide and conquer, right? You pick up people one by one. You don't pick them up all at once so that they can unite with each other and create something. And yet, to me, it seems to me that this is precisely what the U.S. is doing right now. Instead of doing divide and conquer, they're making all these American foes, for lack of a better word, Russia, China, the Middle East, all unite. It's mind-blowing to me. I just don't get it. I don't get what American diplomacy is trying to achieve here. So, no, look, it's very, very troubling. Now, to your point on you know, the world can't afford for China to reopen because then the oil price goes through the roof, a point I agree with you fully with, because China probably right now is under-consuming by about 1.5 million barrels per day. So if they come back in and consume an additional 1.5 million barrels, you have to wonder where that 1.5 million barrels is going to come from. Maybe this is the reason that China isn't reopening. You know, when we're scratching our heads saying, well, you know, China staying locked down makes no sense. You know, the Chinese leadership is first and foremost worried about inflation. So perhaps the Chinese leadership first wants to make sure that they've built the necessary inventories and energy, built up their stock. And I think what people forget is that there was an energy crisis in China last summer. You know, last summer, China ran out of coal, ran out of electricity. That's when China decided to make Bitcoin illegal because it was just consuming too much electricity. You know, they shut down some steel mills, some naval shipyards, and they basically told all the coal miners, all right, guys, go back to the mines and dig out some more coal. So, you know, perhaps, well, not perhaps, the only solution out of our current energy predicament triggered by underinvestment in energy production for the past decade, the only immediate solution is through coal. You and I have discussed this before. I continue to believe that, you know, people get really angry when I say this, because, you know, coal is dirty. But, you know, we've left ourselves in this situation where we're now dependent on coal. So perhaps the answer is, until China has, you know, restocked up on coal, imported a lot from Indonesia, imported a lot from Australia, imported a lot from Russia, do we not reopen? But once that's done, then we can reopen. And yes, it means higher pollution, and yes, it means, you know, terrible news for the planet long term. But maybe that helps prevent oil from going to $200, because if you get there, you start having real inflationary problems, not just in the U.S., but in China as well. And that the Chinese regime just won't have. There are, you know, the Chinese regime is down to being the last inflation hawk in the world.
Well, Louis, what resonated most for me in what you just said is maybe the reason that China is staying in lockdown is because they know that coming out of lockdown is going to trigger a global inflation, which is going to be really, really crazy. And perhaps because they're very good at thinking ahead and planning ahead, maybe what they're doing is just trying to stockpile everything they need so that they can get through that inflation. But I hope that we're in agreement that they wouldn't just stay in lockdown forever. It would be stay in lockdown until they can prepare. Once they've prepared, they're going to come out of lockdown. If it unleashes an inflation, and how could it not when you consider that it's got to drive oil prices dramatically higher? Oil is or energy in general is an input cost to the price of almost everything. So you know there's going to be globally a increase in inflation when China reopens. Doesn't that pretty much eliminate the possibility of the Fed pivoting? I mean, it would mean that the Fed would be pivoting, if they did pivot, into increasing inflation and really risking, you know, almost a hyperinflationary runaway situation. It seems to me like there's a real quandary here, that between China and oil and inflation, the absolute last thing you can afford to do is piss Saudi Arabia off even more, to the point where maybe you get to the point where you say, okay, the inflation's going crazy, the Fed can't pivot, we're really in trouble, and we've just passed the NOPEC bill, and Saudi Arabia just calmly says, yeah, now that you've passed this bill, unfortunately, we can't do business with you anymore, so you'll have to buy your oil elsewhere. And just by the way, China just reopened. We actually kind of coordinated that behind the scenes. We weren't telling you about that. And we've got another buyer for our oil. So since, Mr. President, you've told the American people several times that your country is energy independent, you don't need us anyway, good luck.
Yep. No, then I think that's, well, like I said,
and I've been the gloomy guy. You got to be the one to pull me out of this. You're supposed to say, no, Eric, that's crazy. That's conspiracy theory talk. The reason that's not realistic is fill in the blank, Louis.
Well, okay. We weren't supposed to talk about U.S. diplomacy because there indeed, I find it very hard to not be gloomy. You know, the level of hubris, like I said, that's going on in U.S. diplomacy right now, picking fights with everyone, to me is mind-blowing. And yes, you do leave yourself, you know, you are in an energy crisis, so probably now is not the time to pick a fight with Saudi Arabia. It's, you know, that seems to me pretty elementary. Now would be a good time to restart the Canadian pipelines. And I know this means that, you know, you have to swallow your pride and undo the things. Biden's very first act in office was to block the Keystone Pipeline, right? Which is, you know, was a symbol all in and of itself. But, you know, say, okay, times have changed. We now need to make arrangements. You know, there's a ton of energy in Canada that just requires not so much marginal investment to start flowing into the U.S. So the long-winded answer to your question is, right now, not only is the U.S. picking a fight on Russia, picking a fight on China, picking a fight on OPEC, but it's also picking a fight on climate change. So the bullish argument is that some of these are going to have to go. Now, you're going to have an election coming up in the U.S. in a few weeks, and it seems pretty likely to me that the fight on climate change is going to go the way of the dodo, at least for a little while. And that as the fight on the climate change goes the way of the dodo, then you can get reinvestments into pipelines, into Canada, and you're going to get investments into coal. Because look, at the end of the day, economic activity is energy transformed, right? And we thought that we could massively increase our cost of energy massively, you know, through alternatives and whatever else, and that this would have no impact on economic activity. Turns out that obviously the maths were wrong, and not only do we produce not enough energy, but the cost is much higher, and so we're stuck in the situation we're in now. As you project yourself forward over the next 5 years, you're left with a simple quandary, and that is, who will have the cheap cost of energy looking ahead? And the answer is twofold. It's number one, whoever accepts to trade with Russia, which in essence is China and India. Number two, who will have cheap energy? It will be whoever accepts to turn back to coal, which is basically whoever accepts to tear up COP26 and put the climate change directives on, you know, far into the rearview mirror and decides to just burn coal. Most emerging markets are already there. China's obviously there. India's there. South Africa's there. Brazil's there. All the emerging markets are already there. The question is, does the U.S. join them? And, you know, perhaps following this November election, the U.S. will join them. But all this brings me to another point. You know, I think it was Bruce Kovner of Caxton that used to say that wherever he's made the most money in markets was when consensus held was like firmly of one belief. Meanwhile, the market was already moving in another direction, but consensus hadn't moved. Consensus still believed the one thing. Now, today, the one consensus opinion out there that's held like stronger than anything is that the U.S. is the cleanest dirty shirt, right? That the U.S. is just the only place in the world you can deploy capital. Everywhere else stinks. So you should deploy all your money in the U.S. And I say, okay, well, how clean is this dirty shirt? Because the bond market's down 20% and the equity market's down 25%. I mean, that's a pretty stinky, dirty shirt. It's not that clean at all. Meanwhile, if you look at most emerging markets, the bond markets are flat to marginally down for the year. And a lot of emerging market equity markets, whether you're Indonesia's, your India's, your Brazil's, your Mexico's, your South Africa's, a lot of these guys are flat to up for the year. So everybody's going around telling you, oh, you know, the guys that are getting crushed, the down 20, 25%, that's your clean, dirty shirt. Meanwhile, Brazil, whose bond market's up 10% and equity market's up 10%, Indonesia, you know, basically bond market flat and equity market up 5 or 6%. Now, you don't want those shirts. India, no, you don't want that shirt. So the transition is already happening, and it's happening towards the countries that are either willing to trade with Russia or willing to burn coal. And I know why nobody's talking about it, because this is the most unpolitically correct thing you can talk about. You know, to say, hey, I'm going to invest in the guys that are friendly with Russia and that are burning coal is a sure way to not be invited at next week's dinner party. You know, it's definitely you're going to get kicked out of polite society. But unfortunately, that's the world that we live in. You have to invest in the countries that are, in essence, going to embrace tomorrow's cheap form of energy. And, you know, we might hate it, but it's coal and it's Russia.
You know, this is fascinating, Louis, because when you were saying the most important thing to think about is that variant perception, when you've got one view, but the market has an opposite view, and you're pretty confident that the market's wrong, what I thought you were leading up to was not the cleanest dirty shirt argument, but rather that one of the strongest beliefs that exists in the market now is inflation is transitory, it's already peaked, it's about to go away. And I think you and I both agree that as soon as China opens, price of crude oil goes to the moon. And it's really hard to imagine how inflation comes down when the price of crude oil goes to the moon, considering it's an input cost to almost everything. So on the topic of that variant perception, what do we make of this? What could happen if you and I are right? And, you know, most of the market is positioned around inflation is transitory and about to go away. If it turns out that inflation has only just begun and it's about to get a whole lot worse when China opens, and China's smart enough to see it coming, so they're prepared for it, or they're preparing for it now. And by the time that they reopen, they will be prepared for it, and we're not. What could that mean for markets and the economy?
Well, I think the first thing to acknowledge about inflation is that it's a massively volatile number. You know, when inflation is when it's low, it's quite stable. So you're 1.5-2%, and you hover down there. But once you move above 5%, at least that was the experience of the 1970s. You know, you can be at 8%, and then you're down to 3% the next year, but then you're right back at 10. And that's how inflationary environments work, where you have this volatility. And then because initially, to your point, most people don't buy into it at first. They don't buy into it because, you know, capitalism is a fundamentally deflationary force, right? Every businessman wakes up every morning thinking, how do I produce more with less? This is what everybody's trying to do all day, every day. The reason inflation comes around is, you know, a number of factors. Of course, it's the crazy monetary policies. It's the too much money printing. But invariably, it's just too much government intervention. And today, that's exactly what we have. Today, ask yourself this. Do you have more or less government intervention in your economy than you did a year ago, than you did 3 years ago, than you did 5 years ago? Every day that goes by, you get more government intervention. You know, this week, it was the U.S. government coming in and saying and telling you, look, you're not allowed to sell semiconductors to China anymore. So now all of a sudden, you know, you've just wreaked havoc on a number of supply chains. A number of people who were, you know, producing stuff in China with US semiconductors to sell it all over the world, they have to rethink everything. And the reason they were doing that way in the first place, because that was the most efficient. They'll find a way to cope, because that's what capitalism do, that's what business people do. But when you keep changing the rules, you increase the costs and you lower the productivity. And so I think we're still in the phase of the cycle where we're getting more government intervention rather than less. And that comes across through higher inflation. I mean, find me one place right now. I think we're still in the hubristic phase of governments almost everywhere in Europe and in the US where wherever there's a problem, the governments feel, oh, there's a problem, therefore it is up to me to provide the solution. You know, where nowhere in the world do we have a government that says, oh, there's a problem, I'm going to get out of the way and let the market deal with this. So while we're still in this hubristic phase, I completely agree with you that, you know, while we're not only in an hubristic phase, but we're in such a hubristic phase that our government not only makes things harder for our businesses, but creates massive uncertainty by picking fights everywhere. I mean, does the U.S. government really need to pick a fight with OPEC? I mean, does it really? I understand that Biden's pride was hurt, that, you know, he went to Saudi Arabia and begged for more oil, didn't get it, and then, you know, MBS turns around and slaps him a cut. I understand that's humiliating. Does that still warrant a fight? Is the timing right today to cut China off semiconductors? I mean, what's amidst a massive inflationary crisis in the U.S.? Isn't that like having your priorities a little wrong in terms of, you know, what's important right here, right now? I mean, I guess, you know, people will have different opinions on this, but however you cut it, wars, whether hot wars or cold wars, and we are starting a bunch of cold wars everywhere, are inflationary. You know, the great big deflationary wave really happened with the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War. You know, so we are now at war. People have forgotten that wars are inflationary. And yes, inflation is a volatile number. So, you know, it might be lower in 6 months' time because rents are going down and money supply is going down. And you know, you've had, some energy prices stabilizing. So the year-on-year comparisons will get easier and all that stuff. But to your point, you know, if and when China reopens, a lot of these trends shift into completely different gears. And by the way, on this one more point, you know, you have whatever it is, 8.5% inflation in the US with the US dollar that's gone up 20%. I mean, imagine what inflation would have been if the US dollar hadn't been this strong, right? If the US dollar had been weak or even just flat and import prices had risen the way they should have, then you'd be at double digit easy. Now, I say this because what are the odds, having already risen 20%, that the US dollar rises another 20% over the coming 6 months? I think the answers are the odds are very small. And so imagine an environment where China reopens, oil goes up, and US dollar weakens. What does that do to your inflation data?
Louis, final topic I want to discuss today is one that really concerns me, and frankly, is here at Gloom and Doom Central, as I look around and I listen to the other gloom and doomers, I think they're missing the point, because there's so much concern about, oh boy, this is not looking good. What if we got a stock market crash as bad as 2008? Could be really bad. And I just think to myself, who cares? A stock market crash basically means rich guys aren't as rich anymore, and that trickles down and it screws up the whole economy. And of course, 2008 was a big deal. But something that, from my perception at least, it seems like even professional finance people don't seem to appreciate is the difference between a stock market crash and a bond market crash. If you have a stock market crash, it means rich guys aren't rich anymore. If you have a bond market crash, it means the entire global economy stops because the funding mechanisms for everything are broken. It means grocery stores don't have groceries because the commercial paper system that's needed in order to finance paying for the groceries until they can sell them isn't in place anymore. It means the entire global economy is broken. And, you know, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but if I was going to, because, hey, I'm Mr. Gloom and Doom, it seems, if I'm going to be Mr. Gloom and Doom, I want to worry about a bond market crash. And I'm not saying, you know, it's less likely, I suppose, than a stock market crash, but it seems to me that's the really big risk. And I don't think most people understand how much of a bigger deal a bond market crash would be than a stock market crash. And you know, people say, well, that's crazy, a bond market crash. A bond market is not what you'd expect to crash because the risk capital goes into the stock market. The bond market's the stable one. Well, hang on a second, Louis. If we're at 4% on the U.S. 10-year right now, and you've got around 8 or 9% inflation, and the variant perception you and I have is that when China does reopen, it means inflation is going to go up substantially, not down. Well, wait a minute. Doesn't doubling the interest rate, you know, if you have to match that inflation in order to fight it, you got to go from 4% to 8%. Doesn't that mean a 50% down from here on the bond market?
Yeah. So
is there any pension fund on the planet that could possibly tolerate a 50% down from here on the bond market? And what would be the snowball effect of when they have to start liquidating and bailing out? It just makes the bond market crash worse. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but please tell me why this is crazy conspiracy talk. What's wrong?
I don't think it's crazy conspiracy talk. So to your point,
I want it to be wrong on this.
So I think your starting point is absolutely right. The bond markets matter 10 times more than the equity markets. First, they're bigger. And they hold a lot more, indeed, of the world's long-term savings. But to your point, you know, 2008, the reason 2008 was a disaster was not because equities went down, but because the mortgage bond market imploded. That was the real problem, right? It was the mortgage bonds implosion that triggered the collapse of banks, that triggered the collapse of AIG. That was the real issue, as opposed to,
but
say,
that was just mortgages.
Yep, it was just.
And there was contagion to other markets, but it started just. This is a very, very different cause.
This is much bigger. So if you look, for example, at 2000, 2001, you had a hell of an equity bear market, but by and large, it was like whatever. It was, you know, it was the economy took it in its stride, and you know, there was a small recession, made worse, of course, by 9/11 and all these things. But all in all, the bond markets in 2000, 2001 did their job. I think what's quite worrisome today is if you look at the total amount of capital destruction, and I've published a few charts on this, but if you look at the total amount of capital destruction, we've already destroyed more capital than we did in 2008. Because in 2008, when you lost money on equities, you made it on government bonds. And when you lost money on mortgage bonds, you made it on government bonds. So there was some balancing effect. Here, you know, I'm sure you've seen the charts highlighting that your typical 60-40 portfolio has had its worst returns in 100 years. And, you know, we think of that 60-40 portfolio as grandpa's portfolio, but it's a lot of pension funds portfolios. And, you know, on that note, you might have also seen these charts floating around. If you compare a 30-year gilt to Bitcoin, the 30-year gilt has done worse this year, worse than Bitcoin. So to some extent, we are in the middle of this. You know, you're saying I'm worried about the bond market crash. Well, we're in the middle of it. And that brings me to
another. Are you saying it's only half done?
Well, so here's, I don't know. Dead honest, I don't know. Because here's the interesting thing, right? In the UK, where the crash has been amongst the worst, the UK pension funds were obviously the first to cry uncle. Now, the UK pension fund system is not any small pension fund system. You know, it's actually one of the world's biggest. Of course, the US pension fund system is by far the world's biggest. Australia's is very big. Canada's is very big. And the UK is right up there. So for the UK pension fund system to say, look, we can't take any more losses on bonds or we are going bankrupt and we need central bank intervention here and now, and not discuss it, but we're calling at 10:30 a.m. and by 4 p.m. we're declaring bankruptcy, which is what happened a couple weeks ago, is to me, that was a very big deal because, you know, fundamentally, you know, most of us think of central bank as having two mandates. We think of them as having a mandate on inflation, and we think of them as having a mandate on economic growth slash job creation. But in reality, they have three mandates. And the third mandate is making sure that the governments get funded and that therefore the bond markets are operating fairly smoothly. When you go back to the, you know, the dark days of the COVID lockdowns in March 2020, you know, equity markets were puking and the Fed did nothing until you started to see the government bond market puke, until basically the U.S. Treasuries went no bid. And that's when the U.S. Treasuries went no bid, that's when the Fed stepped in. Now, I highlight this because that's what's just happened in the U.K. In essence, the bond market was going no bid and the pension funds were going bust. And the Bank of England said, okay, well, out of our three mandates right now, we have to forget the inflation mandate. We'll deal with that later. Right now, we have to focus on our bond market stability mandate. And so now you have a Bank of England that is adopting yield curve controls, just like the Bank of Japan adopted yield curve controls. And on this, you know, through my career, I've seen the Bank of Japan do different things, and they were always at the forefront, and they were always made fun of when they first did it. So, you know, the Bank of Japan was the first to go into zero interest rates, right? And you remember, and at the time, everybody was like, these Japanese, they're just nuts. Zero interest rates, that makes zero sense. Like, what's wrong with these guys? And then, you know, within a couple of years, everybody was at zero interest rates. Then Japan did QE, same story. Then Japan did negative interest rates, and same story. Then everybody followed on negative interest rates. And now Japan does yield curve controls. You know, my take is we'll all end up with yield curve controls, except, of course, the countries that didn't follow crazy monetary policies and crazy fiscal policies, who didn't blow out their government debt to kingdom come, who didn't basically undermine the very structure of their bond market through crazy policies, and who continue to undermine it through crazy fiscal policies. Because amidst all this, you know, what government is legitimately tightening its belt? You know, most of the governments everywhere are going around saying, oh, we have an energy crisis. Well, let's print more money to deal with the energy crisis. You know, Germany just announced a 200 billion euro plan that's 5% of GDP plan to basically subsidize energy for its consumers. France just did 100 billion. You know, that's 3% of France's GDP. These are big numbers just to deal with the energy crisis. So all this to say that in this environment, I think basically all the major countries are going to deal with yield curve control. And as they do, the trend that has already started of massive emerging market bond outperformance and massive emerging market equity outperformance will continue, because that will be the one place where capital, lo and behold, actually ends up being somewhat protected. And so today, you know, everybody's running around saying, oh, I have to be in the U.S. because the U.S. is the cleanest dirty shirt, even though I'm taking a 20% hit to my bonds and a 25% hit to my equities. This is, you know, this is where I have to be. Forget it. It's not. Where you have to be is in the places that aren't following crazy fiscal and crazy monetary policies. You have to be in the places that aren't declaring war to, you know, the climate on the one hand and to four other countries on the other, and that are trying to, you know, keep their show on the road and keep their heads down. Places like Brazil, places like Indonesia, places like India, places like Singapore. You know, fundamentally, I think there's three ways to make money in markets. You run a momentum trade, you run a return to the mean trade, or you run a carry trade. And right now, there's only two asset classes that tick all three of these boxes. It's energy on the one hand, it's emerging markets on the other. And, you know, I would say, well, if you've got all three, momentum, positive carry, and return to the mean attributes, then you back up the truck. You back up the truck because that doesn't come around that often. The reason it's coming around right now is because, you know, we're in a global liquidity crisis, we're in a bear market. So you're being given a great opportunity to pick up a lot of these assets for very cheap. But make no mistake about it, the next big bull market is over there. So we can indeed sit around and think, oh my God, things are terrible. we're in amidst this big crisis, and for all the reasons that your previous guests have discussed and that you've discussed as well, etc. Or we can think, okay, there's a crisis for sure. Where's the opportunity? The opportunity set is energy. It's emerging markets. Let's not overthink it. Let's just do that.
Louis, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to ask you first what you do at GavCal, which is an institutional advisory firm. But you also now have Evergreen GavCal after you acquired or partnered with our friend David Hayes' company, Evergreen. For our listeners, both on the institutional and high-end retail side who want to follow your work, please tell us where they can do so.
Well, first, thanks again for having me. Yeah, no, we do lots of different things. We publish research for institutional investors at gavcal.com, GAVEKAL.com. That's the best place to follow us. I don't really spend, unfortunately, much time on social media. We also have a free newsletter that goes through the private wealth arm of GavCal, which Evergreen GavCal. And we're hoping to ramp that up, this private wealth part, in the coming years or in the coming quarters. We'll be making announcements on that front very soon. So yeah, the best way to contact us, either through the website, gavcal.com, or evergreengavcal.com.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac-certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Louis Vincent Gav. Now, joining us in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, Eric, I have to admit, I've been one of those traders focusing on the Fed pivot, and I have to say that I think that Louis is onto something, because if China does pivot, and it did happen, it would be a substantial impact on the inner markets and maybe a catalyst for some of these new trends. What did you take away from the interview?
Patrick, what I really love about interviewing super smart guys like Louis Vincent Gav is they often take something that I already knew, such as the fact that the big catalyst for oil prices moving higher will be China coming out of lockdown, and just reframe it in a way which is much more concise and much more focused. And in this case, what I'm talking about is I've been talking, as Macro Voices listeners know, for months about the fact that the catalyst that would get us to much higher oil prices would be China reopening. I hadn't really thought about it in terms of observing this political process and thinking about, okay, it's really when Xi Jinping pivots from his personal policy commitment that he's made. So looking for signs of when that's coming, because I agree with Louis, that's going to be the big trigger for a whole bunch of things, for a new round of inflation, for higher oil prices. It's going to send a shockwave through global markets. Now, how do you know when that's coming? Well, understand a little bit better what's going on in Xi Jinping's life. This National Congress in China right now is obviously one potential turning point where we might see some kind of announcement. I'm certainly going to start doing my homework and try to figure out what the next thing to watch is after that one. Louis's words were humbling, though, when he said, I said, Louis, when is China going to come out of lockdown? Because it doesn't make sense. They've been in lockdown for the last year. And Louis was the first to say, I've been trying to figure that out for a year. I don't get it. So when is China going to pivot? That's, probably, as Louis says, more important than the Fed pivot, but almost nobody is looking at it. So I'm certainly going to be watching much more closely.
All right, let's get to that chart deck. Now, listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have our Research Roundup email, that means you are not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Louis' picture saying, looking for the downloads. And joining us to talk some charts is Nick Galarnik. So, Nick, great to have you on again here. Let's talk some charts.
Great to be on, Patrick. On page two, we have the SPX. Eric, what are you thinking on this?
I think there's a very real chance that we're seeing the beginning of a substantial bounce that has the potential to be as big as the July-August summer rally. The setup here was too many people were expecting an October crash, so they were fully hedged for it. So the market did the opposite. I don't think anything has actually gotten better, but markets never move in straight lines, and this one was already oversold. Now, to be clear, I am absolutely not ruling out an outright crash. The geopolitical situation couldn't be a whole lot worse, and our policymakers seem intent on making it worse if they possibly can with ill-conceived policy. But with that caveat firmly in place, it looks to me like maybe it's time for a significant bounce. I still think we're going to see lower lows before this is over, but it feels to me like we're maybe at the beginning of a bounce. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, Eric, that's sort of my thinking too. That Nick, I know you were watching a couple of these levels on the S&P. Where are your levels?
I'm seeing heavy resistance overhead at 3,800 roughly. Current spot as we speak is 3,675 roughly. Support is at the lows of 3550, heavy support at 3500. Looking out to the November 11th OPEX, reason being is that that factors in the November midterm elections in the United States. Expected move right now is about 210 points in either direction, and that denotes about a 5.7% move. So we can see a lot of volatility over the next couple of weeks, and then it should die down a bit. What levels are you watching for on the S&P right now, Patrick?
Well, you know what? This has been a pretty significant downtrend. What was interesting is on that CPI number last week, this started with some heavy selling, and then we had that huge intraday reversal that really kind of solidified at least a short-term low. There's a lot of people out there that are talking about whether or not that could have been a more meaningful bottom, and that's really what's on my mind. I mean, right now, obviously, like you were referring, we are in the OPEX going into the option expiration, which usually pins the market, at least for the next day. But next week could be quite volatile. And one of the things that's on my mind is whether or not the bulls can actually follow through and beat that October high and get this market above 3,800. Because really, that could set in motion a rally into the midterm elections and potentially stress the top side of the market. But what is interesting is how fast traders are always quick to want to buy dips. And this market is just set up for so much volatility. And with these little fake outs, it wouldn't surprise me if the market causes some serious moves, but like I would actually prefer this bull move to materialize. But if for whatever reason we find ourselves next week with the market fading below 3,600, it could cause another wave of liquidations that could see us heading to some of those big targets that some of our guests have had down at 3,200 or lower. And really, the big question is the market going to stay flat into elections? I think there's a big move coming, and whether the bulls can actually turn the trend, it's going to be all about that 3,800 level early next week. But, you know, Nick, though, I want to talk this VIX on page three, because the VIX and the volatility has stayed at elevated levels through all of this. And that really just depicts the fact that people are grabbing at some volatility premium going into these November elections. What's your thinking here on the VIX?
Well, looking at the VIX right now, spot is roughly 31, which denotes about 2% movements each day in broad markets. Again, looking at the skew, we can see that the IV is spiked for the November OPEX. Thereafter, it kind of settles down a bit. So I expect some serious volatility into the November 8th midterm elections, followed by a decline in volatility. However, if we do get above 35, look out, because we have seen in the past when we break above that key level, we can push as high as perhaps 50 or so, which would see us moving about 3.5% on average per day. I do agree that we may see some upside in the broad markets in the short term, especially if earnings are better than expected, but I think it'll be kind of short-lived overall. So yeah, keep an eye on the VIX, but remember that risk off above VIX 30, and you know, playing safe here and protecting your chips a bit is probably a good way to play it in the short term. Now, moving on to the US dollar on page 4, Eric, has anything changed in your thinking?
Well, as I pointed out last week, the blow-off top and trend reversal to the downside that so many people were sure was going to happen hasn't happened yet. Now, we haven't seen new highs above 115 on the Dixie yet, but to my eye, nothing about the chart rules out that outcome. So as far as I'm concerned, it's wait-and-see time, and a sustained move to new highs on the Dixie would signal a markedly increased risk of a global foreign exchange crisis.
No, Eric, it's interesting that you make those comments on the dollar. Like, the trend is still up, and every dip's been bought. So when we're looking at this chart, it's hard to make an argument that the bulls have dropped the ball yet. But you see such an overbought US dollar yen. That yen has been collapsing. You see that there's probably already meaningful bottoms maybe put in the pound sterling. And so really, in order for there to be a proper US dollar advance, it's going to have to come on the euro heading down to 95 cents or lower. And so there's, I think, fewer and fewer things that are working in the favor of the US dollar bulls on the short term. Doesn't mean it won't go higher, but right now it's I'm starting to ask the question as to whether there's enough gas in the tank to keep this going. Topping formations typically involve testing of highs on numerous occasions. One of the things that would be really interesting on the dollar would be if we did see a quick surge that broke the dollar to a higher high. Let's say we saw Dixie 115, 116 on the upside, driven by, let's say, a euro drop toward 95 cents or lower. And then we see that there's a big reversal and it comes right back down. Then that could be something that could mark a key turn point. Now, I'm not predicting that per se, but I'm not so sure that I want to be too high conviction on the dollar, and I'm much more willing to consider a trend change if the technicals start to show it, which of course are not here right now.
No, Patrick, I definitely agree. And it might not be bad time to go along some flights to Tokyo right now, but let's move on to crude oil on page 5 over here. Patrick, what levels are you watching right now?
Right. So, I mean, we heard, the levels Eric is watching here, but I think here that it's really interesting. Obviously, we had, the administration come out with once again using the SPR as a weapon to suppress prices of crude oil. And what was interesting is that on the first reaction, crude oil dropped. And then it reversed. And what's interesting is that the lows of crude oil held toward its September lows. And one of the things I'm going to be watching very closely this week is whether or not the bulls can actually follow through back to and above 90. I mean, at this moment, any failed rallies below $90 can still roll oil over and keep it weak on the short term. I think in order for the bulls to solidify a new bull trend, we're going to need to see some sustained follow through to really kind of put the momentum in their favor. And that's certainly going to be what I'm watching. Now, let's move on though to page 6 where I have gold. Now, Eric, I have some insights on this weakness, but what's your thinking?
Well, Patrick, we had another massive down candle on Wednesday, almost reaching new cycle lows. Now, the explanation for that is easy. The dollar was up, so gold is down because gold hasn't really done anything except trade inversely to the dollar. But this happened in the face of mounting geopolitical tension. Now, I'm still long, but frankly, gold just isn't behaving the way almost everyone predicted that it would under these circumstances. We really need to get our friend Ola Hansen back on the show. The last letter that I saw from Ola, he was still very much bullish gold. I'd love to understand in better detail why he holds that view. Maybe we can get him lined up for a feature interview.
You know, Eric, I hear you on the idea that gold is a hedge on geopolitical tensions, but the one trend that we have seen over and over again has simply been that gold has been acting like a cross currency to the US dollar, and you can literally overlay the chart of the euro on gold and see the similar correlation. I feel that the next dollar move is going to very much influence this move on gold. If we see the dollar struggling to make new highs, that could correspond with gold holding these lows along the bottom. And at the same time, if that much more bullish scenario happens and the Dixie's heading to 118 to 120 on the upside, I think that gold will just continue to follow that correlation and weaken down below 1600 in an impulse. So I'm cautiously actually optimistic gold, but I really think it's going to, at this moment, the low in gold will very much correspond with inevitable high in the dollar. And I think you have to watch them together.
Now, moving on to natural gas on page 7, quite the pullback. What do you make of this drop over here?
It's interesting. A lot of people keep talking about this weakness and like a big surprise. But what's not being visible here on this nat gas chart is the term structure. And what's interesting is that the term structure, the long-term nat gas futures have always been down in this $4.5 to $5.5 area. We saw substantial backwardation in the term structure when nat gas was trading up in the $8+ area. And what we really have seen now is that backwardation just being taken right out. I mean, the farther parts of the term structure have barely moved, and this has really just been everything coming back almost in line. It'll be really interesting to see whether or not new catalysts emerge that could once again steepen that and bring the spot prices of nat gas up. But when you're looking out a few months, nat gas is really only up near about 590 on as you going out here a few months forward. And so really this idea of you know, $7 to $9 gas has really been just completely priced out of the entire term structure. And so I personally think while the support is coming in after such a decline, probably not too much immediate downside considering we're going into these winter months. But right now, I'm not so sure that a bounce is going to be much more than a dollar on the upside. So it's going to be one of the more interesting things to watch as we move forward here. Now, on page 8 here, Nick, I've got the copper chart. And this has been also an interesting one. It's especially after listening to Louis' interview, thematically talking about this idea of what if China opens up and what would be the implications. And one of the thing, the commodities that I would suspect would positively react to a China reopening could be copper. And what's interesting is that really since that bloodbath in the summer where we saw copper prices wiped out from $4.50 almost down to $3 during the month of June into early July. And since then, we've really just seen a very long extended basing formations. Basically, copper really had no catalyst to go lower, but absolutely no reason to go higher. And the curious thing will be is if Louis' perspective does start to come to fruition for whatever reason, will that manifest in a turn in the charts on the copper? I think you can draw a descending trend line along all these September, October highs, look for that breakout north of 350, 360 to kind of really ask the question as to whether copper is turning.
On page 9, we have uranium. Nice trend over there. Do you think it continues?
Yeah, you know, Nick, this is interesting because it's one of the few commodities that actually has been bullish in the last 3 months. And I mean, obviously, uranium went through an incredibly challenging second into third quarter as it really got hammered almost 40% from top to bottom. But really, after solidifying that summer low, we've really seen progressively good price action. Every dip has been bought above a lot of its key trend lines and moving averages, and generally is showing signs of accumulation. It's one of the few charts that continues to behave bullishly. Interestingly enough, obviously because of some M&A activity with Cameco, the uranium stocks and the uranium ETFs have really been challenged in this period. But really, when you're looking at the underlying commodity, the commodity continues to do well. It'd be really interesting to see if those uranium stocks start to catch up now that all of that news is behind it.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart techs, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, Eric, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, and a number of links to some articles we found interesting. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we'll consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases, and also follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thank you for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.